Coming up on KUCB News, Alaska State Troopers stop drugs bound for Sandpoint, and the Smithsonian returns human remains to Bristol Bay. Stay tuned.
Local news is sponsored by Alpha Welding and Boat Repair Incorporated, providing boat repairs and conversions in Unalaska Dutch Harbor for the last 25 years. Our professionals are trained to use heavy-duty equipment, including boom trucks, shears, brakes, a water jet cutting machine, and a punch machine. Our fully equipped metal fabrication welding shop and machine shop are located at 1149 East Broadway. Alpha Welding and Boat Repair can be reached at 581-1785 or 581-2666.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Zoe Sobel with some local news on Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. Alaska State Troopers have seized another cache of heroin and methamphetamine bound for Sandpoint, marking the community's second airport drug bust in the last month. Troopers arrested 21-year-old Christian Anderson Nutt on September 29th, following a joint narcotics investigation with the Sandpoint Police Department. Police Chief Hal Henning says the Sandpoint man was, quote, exhibiting drug trafficking behavior, unquote, at the Anchorage airport, which led officials to examine his luggage with drug-sniffing dogs. Their search revealed almost 20 grams of heroin, more than 50 grams of meth, and $6,500 in cash. In total, Henning says the bus stopped 720 doses of drugs from being sold in Sandpoint, where the street value is estimated at about $72,000. Anderson Nutt was taken into custody and charged with two felony counts of misconduct involving controlled substances. Now out on bail, he's due in Anchorage court October 24th. The Unalaska City Council meets tonight. The regular session will be the last under councilors Rochelle Hatfield, Udelka LeClaire, and John Waldron, who were recently ousted in the municipal election. The council is expected to certify election results and swear in newly elected members Sherry Coleman, James Fitch, and Dennis Robinson. Councilors are also scheduled to discuss options for recruiting a new city manager and an emergency funding request from the clinic. The City Council meets tonight at 6 o'clock at City Hall. Last month, the Yupik village of Igiagig celebrated the reburial of 24 of their ancestors, whose bones were taken by a Smithsonian anthropologist in 1931. The Smithsonian has repatriated more human remains and funerary objects to tribes in Alaska than in any other state. This repatriation, however, was the first in Bristol Bay. The director of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History was present and helped fill the graves. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Three handmade wooden coffins sat in the middle of St. Nicholas Orthodox Church in the tiny village of Igiagig. Inside the coffins were the bones of 24 men, women, and children from the now-abandoned settlement of Kaskanak. Their remains were unearthed 87 years ago by Alice Herdlichka, who was the head of the anthropology department in what is now the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. During his 1931 trip to Bristol Bay, he likely excavated remains near Aleknagik, Ekwok, Kalikinik, and other communities as well. The question of how people originally came to North America and from where drove him to dig up the bones of Native Americans all around the United States. It's estimated that he took thousands to Washington, D.C. for further research. After more than eight decades in the museum's collection, Igiagig's ancestors finally returned home.
Lord, to the souls of thy departed servants, for these thy servants of God.
Reverend David Askok told the congregation that this reburial was a time to remember to honor loved ones, living and dead.
Our healing now begins. We know the sacredness of our graves and our loved ones and those that were there, and this is the peace that comes to us. We have to show love to all your loved ones.
People sang as they walked in procession around the coffins. Then the wooden boxes were screwed shut and carried out of the church. There to help carry the coffins was Kirk Johnson, the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. The Smithsonian is ostensibly an institution that collects objects, but as Johnson explained, giving history back has become part of its duty in recent decades.
There was a movement started in the 70s as Native American cultures began to realize that much of their material culture had been appropriated and moved into museums.
There are several laws that now govern the repatriation of Native American remains and funerary objects. The National Museum of the American Indian Act and Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, passed in 1989 and 1990, require museums to make these materials available to federally recognized tribes.
Some of their grandparents or their more recent relatives are actually in museums as collection items, which just doesn't make much sense from a human point of view. There is something that was very unfair that was done here, and we want the tribes, the groups, the corporations to be able to petition to have their bodies and their funerary objects returned to them.
But that process can be complicated. To start with, when the National Museum of the American Indian Act was passed, museums throughout the United States had the remains of about 200,000 Native American individuals. The National Museum of Natural History had 19,000 of those. The museum cataloged its collection and reached out to tribes with that information, but it can't just start sending out bones. Every repatriation starts with a request made by a tribe. Then the museum works to verify the remains or objects requested are culturally affiliated with that tribe. When it came to this particular repatriation, Herdlichka wrote that he excavated the bones at Kaskanak. The tricky part was identifying which abandoned village that is. Bill Billick, director of the Smithsonian's Repatriation Office, also attended the reburial in Igyogig.
We went through all the evidence, and this is assembling everything from looking at the human remains, looking at the original documents, looking at diaries of the person who collected the remains, learning from people in the community, the history of the community. And we were lucky to work with Alexander Salmon, who provided lots of really important information that made our work a lot easier.
Salmon, an Igyogig local, researched the history of Igyogig and the community's old village sites extensively for her master's thesis. That work became invaluable in establishing that the Igyarakmiut, the people of Igyogig, are connected to the people of Kaskanak. She spearheaded the project out of respect for her ancestors. What she didn't anticipate was the profound impact the repatriation would have on her community.
This was a collaborative effort between the Smithsonian and our village, but it was us telling them that these are ours, this is who we are, and it's not anthropology coming from the other direction, telling you who you are and where you came from. This has been part of just reclaiming everything back, like our languages back, our native languages, our cultural knowledge.
85-year-old Alice Zakhar is an Igyogig elder. She only speaks her native language. Annie Wilson asked her in Yupik what she thought about the repatriation and translated.
I guess with everything that's been going on, she's kind of a little bit emotional at the moment. But she feels really honored to have all that taken back down to there.
When the bones left the church after the funeral service, they had one more stretch of their journey. The coffins were loaded into a skiff, and the rest of the village piled into a few other boats. The foliage along the banks of the river was bright with fall colors on the 15-minute boat ride from Igyogig to Kanuyang. It was decided that the ancestors would be reburied there instead of at Kaskanak, because Kaskanak is now on private property. Kanuyang is a more recently abandoned village site, and one that belongs to the village corporation. At the old site, a hole was already dug in the hillside overlooking the Kwijak River. The priest prayed as the coffins were lowered, then he sprinkled dirt into the graves with a long-handled shovel. He passed the shovel to Johnson. Alongside the director of the Museum of Natural History, the children of Igiagig tossed in dirt by the handful. The rest of the village pitched in, and soon only three white crosses and a fresh pile of soil marked the grave. With the bones finally laid to rest, the village performed a traditional Yupik dance. Facing east, with dance fans held high, they blessed their ancestors and reclaimed two dozen members of their community. In Igiagig, I'm Avery Lill.
A controversial ballot initiative intended to protect salmon habitat has cleared a major hurdle, setting up what could be an intense political fight. A judge in Anchorage ruled yesterday that Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott was wrong to deny the initiative, organized by the nonprofit Stand for Salmon. Mallott rejected the ballot measure last month, arguing it would tie the state's hands and prioritize salmon habitat over other potential uses of state land, like mining or oil development. The state says if it's enacted, the measure could complicate efforts to rebuild projects ranging from pipelines to the proposed Pebble Mine. The initiative also drew opposition from a wide range of industry groups. At a hearing last week, the attorney defending the ballot initiative argued it isn't aimed at prohibiting development, though it would add to the permitting process. Judge Mark Ridner agreed. He wrote it's, quote, pure speculation, unquote, to predict the impact of the initiative. Mike Wood, one of the ballot measure's organizers, applauded the decision.
I think the ruling that the judge had was awesome. You know, set politics aside and read it for what it is. And I think he did that.
Wood, a commercial fisherman, was involved in opposition to the Susitna Dam. Marliana Hall is executive director of the Resource Development Council, one of the groups opposed to the ballot initiative. Hall says she's disappointed and her group is asking the state to appeal.
Unfortunately, this initiative, as it is, poses a grave threat to community and resource development. It puts economic activities highly at risk.
Stand for Salmon can now begin collecting signatures. It aims to get the initiative on the ballot in 2018. Lawyers with the state say they're evaluating whether to appeal the decision to the Alaska Supreme Court. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Zoe Sobel. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. Please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecast.